Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3008, United States of America versus Derek Cook, appellant. Ms. Petras for the appellant, Mr. Ambrosino for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mary Petras, on behalf of the appellant Derek Cook, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Because Mr. Cook's sentencing range was reduced by the amended guidelines, the district court had the authority to resentence Mr. Cook pursuant to Section 3582C2. In 1994, Mr. Cook was sentenced to a term of 240 months. That sentence was the product of a guidelines process that was based on the determination of a guideline sentencing range, followed by a comparison of that range to the statutory minimum and maximum. Section 3582 requires only that the sentence be based on a sentencing range that was reduced. The district...
Let's focus on that. You're reading that as applying only to the range, so if the guidelines play any role in what's going on in the sentencing, as they always do, and the range has been lowered, then the authority kicks in.
That's correct, Your Honor, because that's the process that the guidelines requires. And that is...
Suppose that refers to term of imprisonment.
So if the statute was written differently, and the statute said that I might have misunderstood the question.
Well, no, just look at the language. I agree there's a potential ambiguity there, but there are two things that clause can refer back to. One is term of imprisonment, the other is sentencing range.
Well, what the statute requires is if the term of imprisonment was based on a sentencing range that's subsequently been lowered. So if in the process of coming to what the sentence was, the sentencing range has been lowered by the amendment, then the authority kicks in.
Does that make any sense, that reading?
The reading of whether
or not... In other
words,
if you're dealing, as you are here, with a case where the sentence is completely preempted by something else, does it make any sense to say that the authority here, based on a change under 9940, should have any impact on it?
It does, because if you didn't read it that way, then there would be essentially absurd results. For example, the guidelines require that you go through this process of determining what the guideline range is, and the statute does refer to the sentencing range. There's only one range, and that's in parts 1-4 of the guidelines. Only then is the court to turn to part 5 that includes the comparison of that range to statutory mandatory minimums and maximums. For example, if the court read that to mean that if the sentence ultimately became the maximum sentence, then the authority wouldn't kick in, that would mean in a case where a person's guidelines were greater than the statutory maximum. For example, if a person had a statutory maximum sentence of 240 months because they were sentenced under only the lower level drug offense for possessing with intent to distribute a detectable amount, and they received the sentence of 240 months because their guidelines say were over 240 months, 262 to something. The court then would have determined the guideline range, determined that it was 262 to whatever, and then turned to Part 5, G1.1 of the guidelines and compared that to the statutory maximum, and then imposed the maximum because it was... because the guidelines were greater than the maximum. So you impose a sentence of 240 months. If that person's guidelines subsequently are amended to be below the 240 months, then the court would be able to go in and sentence to less than the statutory maximum. But if we read the statute...
It makes sense for the maximum, not for the minimum, does it?
No, it doesn't make sense for the minimum. It doesn't make sense for either because, for example, if a person, if you read the statute to mean once that you get to 5G 1.1, if you determine that the minimum trumps the guideline range and you can never go back to that decision, that would mean individuals who were sentenced to the 60-month mandatory minimum because their guideline range is, for example, if the guideline range is 57 months to 68 months, and that person's given a 60-month sentence because that was the mandatory minimum. I'm sorry, I need to step back for a second because I do have it in my brief, the example.
I mean, it seems to me that what you're arguing for essentially is a sort of random retroactive application of Apprendi.
No. Here's the example I was trying to give.
But under your reading, the fact that the guidelines have played some role in the intellectual process, though not necessarily having any effect at all on the actual outcome, someone who has been sentenced in violation of Apprendi, as we now know, gets a bonus not available to other people sentenced in violation of Apprendi.
That's not what we're doing at all, because in fact Mr. Cook wasn't sentenced in violation of Apprendi because the sentence was within the statutory maximum as for the offense of conviction. He was sentenced to 240 months. He was convicted of the offense of possessing with intent to distribute a detectable amount. The maximum sentence is 240 months. So there was no actual Apprendi.
Well, you think there's a violation of the statute, right? You do think?
I do think there's a violation of the statute.
So the question is whether or not we can retroactively examine the sentence, the error that you say is in the statute. Although I must say that the case you rely on, which is Webb, itself relies on Apprendi as a guide for interpreting. So that to distinguish the constitutional issue from the statutory issue is very difficult. But that said, you are saying that we need to reopen that question.
I am saying that if the guidelines are reduced and the court has the authority to resentence and chooses to, and if I can just step back for 1 second and go back to Judge Williams' question, the example that I was saying that would result in absurd results if you cannot go back at and look again at the 5G 1.1 comparison. If a person's convicted of possessing with intent to distribute 5 grams, they have a mandatory minimum sentence of 60 months. If their guidelines say were 70 to 87 months, and that person filed for a reduction based on the amended crack cocaine guidelines. The court would then go back and redo the guidelines by substituting the amended provision and determine that the 57 to 71 month guideline range now applies. So his guidelines have been reduced. Under the government's analysis and the district court's analysis, that's all you can do under the guidelines. You can't then revisit these other guideline provisions, and you wouldn't be able to go back to 5G 1.1. Originally, the court determined that under 5G 1.1, the guideline range was greater than the mandatory minimum, and so they imposed a sentence within the guideline range. But if you can't go back and revisit that, you would essentially be saying that the court could then impose a sentence within the amended guideline range of 57 to 71 months. But that's not correct because there's a statutory mandatory minimum of 60 months.
I don't understand the argument. If an example you gave, if the guidelines are above the mandatory minimum, then you could certainly say, on one interpretation of the words based on, that the person's sentence was based on a guideline range that has been lowered. So you could go back and lower it. You couldn't lower it below the mandatory minimum, but you could lower it.
Correct.
So what's wrong with that argument?
All I'm saying is our case is no different than that. In doing that, the court goes back and looks
Your case is you have to admit it's different than that. You can't say it's no different than that, right?
Logically.
It's different in the sense that at least if you use the words based on to mean significantly based on, substantially based on, decisively based on, in this case, this person's sentence is almost in every possible way based on the mandatory minimum, not on the guidelines.
Except almost is not enough. What the statute says is if it was based on a sentencing range. So when you look at how...
In this case, it's wholly based on the mandatory minimum and nothing else.
it wasn't based wholly on the mandatory minimum, because if you look back at what happened before the district court at the original sentencing, is they determined what the guideline range was. There's a whole process that has
there to is, be. There is, but it was irrelevant, right? As long as it's below the mandatory minimum, they could manipulate the guideline ranges as much as they want, but it could not affect the ultimate result. Isn't that right? Isn't that right?
Ultimately, in this case, it didn't.
In any case.
Find that. But that doesn't mean you don't go through the process of determining whether or not the sentencing range has been reduced.
Right, but it is the fact that in any case in which the guidelines are below the mandatory minimum, they do not affect the result. Isn't that right?
Yes, but it's also a fact that in every one of those cases, in order to get to that mandatory minimum sentence under the guidelines, you go through a specific process that includes the determination of a sentencing range.
In Lafayette, have you read our recent decision?
Yes, I have, Your Honor.
All right. Presumably, the government is going to argue that our statement that under 3582C2, you can't get into sentencing adjustments that are wholly unrelated to the adjustment as a result of the amendment to the guideline range. But then there's this sentence in Lafayette that says, here, the district court already had discretion within the revised guideline range to do anything, from leaving Lafayette's sentence untouched, as it did, to ordering him released immediately.
Correct.
In other words, I'm not sure, the court made that statement in connection with distinguishing the Ninth Circuit's decision in Hicks, but it seems to suggest that at step one, the district court, quote, do anything. And that's basically your argument in part. Here, I gather, that there's this step one you have to go through. Now, of course, in Lafayette, we weren't dealing with a situation involving a mandatory minimum. Now, I would like to know, just for the record, in the district court, did your client argue that even assuming the district court properly determined the drug quantity, it was plain error to apply the mandatory minimum since your client was convicted of a crime for which there was no mandatory minimum?
No, he didn't make that argument.
So that argument is being made for the first time on appeal?
Well, that's not the argument that we're making.
Well, you say that the district court didn't have to repeat the error. You're not making that argument? If you're not, you're not. I just need to be clear.
I'm not saying that the district court had to resentence Mr. Cook. And that's what Lafayette said, essentially, is the district court in Lafayette didn't reopen the sentencing because the district court chose not to exercise its discretion under 3582 to resentence. What I'm saying here is the district court erred in finding that it didn't have the discretion to resentence Mr. Cook. And once you get over that problem and correct the error that the court didn't have the discretion to resentence him, then it's up to the district court. The district court could then say, well, okay, I had the discretion to resentence him, but I don't have to, even though in our view the sentence is illegal because it was 240 months and was the mandatory minimum when a mandatory minimum didn't apply. We're not arguing that. What we're arguing is once the district court understands that it has the authority to resentence and chooses to reduce Mr. Cook's guideline, if it chooses to reduce Mr. Cook's sentence, and if it chooses to reduce Mr. Cook's sentence, that must be a legal sentence.
All right, but then you're back to Judge Garland's point, aren't you? That the district court says, yeah, I could do all that, but there's a mandatory minimum. So that's why I asked the question, was this other argument ever made to the district court?
Yes. That argument was made that once you get through the process, once you understand that because your guideline sentencing range, the only range that everyone agrees applied to Mr. Cook, has been reduced, and so you have the authority to resentence him, then you must impose a legal sentence. And you have the authority to sentence him to anything between keeping it to the 240 months, because that was the statutory maximum, or imposing the sentence within the amended guideline range. That's the argument that Mr. Cook makes, and that's what he makes here. He's not saying that the court has to do anything, because under 3582, the court has discretion. But once the court has discretion, the court should impose a legal sentence. So while the court may choose to still keep it a 240-month sentence, the statutory maximum, the court should not look at it as if there's a mandatory minimum when everyone agrees he was convicted of possession with intent to distribute a detectable amount.
But that's the question. This is not a case like Lafayette in which the district court had discretion. In fact, in Lafayette, the court says that the Apprendi argument in that case, which, by the way, was exactly the same as this Apprendi argument, right?
No, I actually represented Mr. Lafayette.
I actually wrote the opinion in Mr. Lafayette's
case, so I'm
familiar with it, too.
I understand, but the Apprendi argument that Mr. Lafayette was making was, the district court, you have to sentence me correctly now. You have to change my sentence because once you said what Mr. Lafayette was saying on appeal, I didn't represent him on appeal, and he wasn't really making this argument before the district court, but before the appellate court, he said when the court denied my resentencing under 3582, they essentially reimposed a sentence, and that sentence is illegal, and they can't do that. But what this court said, and obviously the court knows better than I what you said,
was... The nature of his original Apprendi argument was that their mandatory minimums were applied here and they couldn't constitutionally be done without a finding. We found that because there was a consecutive sentencing, that it was harmless error. What's the nature of his argument? What was the nature of his argument before this, the 3582 panel?
Oh, I see, because you're referring to the original Lafayette.
Right. What's the nature of the 3582 argument?
Lafayette, when he was appealing his 3582 motion, said that when the court denied it on a discretionary basis, saying based on his institutional conduct and his lack of remorse, I don't want to resentence him. And what Lafayette said was, well, when the court denied my 3582 motion, the court essentially reimposed a sentence. And when it did so, it violated Apprendi because it was higher than the statutory maximum of 240 months. And what this court said was, no, whatever errors happened in your original sentencing, it didn't happen when the court denied your motion and decided not to exercise its discretion to reimpose a sentence. And then the court, and I think this is very significant, and the point that Judge Rogers, I think, was making, was in referred to the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Hicks and said, essentially, if Hicks is correct, it's because when you recalculate a sentence under 3582, and when a court says, okay, I have the discretion to resentence and I'm going to resentence, that sentence has to be legal.
But Hicks, the way I read what the court said is if you come under 3582C, then you can apply Booker thereafter. This is, by the way, the Supreme Court just granted cert on that question. That's not the question we have here. The question we have here is does the defendant come with under 3582 in the first place? And to get to 3582 in the first place, on your view, the reason is because there was a guideline manipulation underneath the maximum. On another view, the only way you can get to 3582 is if the maximum was wrongly decided. And that seems to be the argument he made below here.
Well, the argument we made below here was that because it was based in part on a sentencing range, mm-hmm. that range has been reduced, you have the authority to resentence. And I do agree that the issue here is one of statutory construction of whether or not 3582, when it says you have the authority to resentence if the sentence was based on a sentencing range, if that includes the type of sentence that Mr. Cook received, where his range was determined and then that range under 5G 1.1 was essentially trumped by what they determined was the guideline sentence, which became the mandatory minimum. But very significantly, the statute refers to the sentencing range. It doesn't say the guideline sentence, and the government uses those two interchangeably.
Right, I appreciate that. The government's analysis may be wrong, but in terms of basing it on 5G. But you could turn this around quite easily on you, which is it was not based on a sentencing range at all. It was based on the mandatory minimum. And that's the reason why 3582 doesn't apply.
But if you read the statute so restrictively, then you're essentially reading language into the statute to say that if a defendant was sentenced within a guideline range, it doesn't say that. It could have said that if it meant what the court is saying, that you have to have been sentenced within the range to have a reduction, or it could have said based solely on the guideline range. It doesn't say that.
Well, it could have said a lot of things, but based on some, at least, what do you do with the ending part of Lafayette, where the court says that the mandatory minimum supervised release term can't be considered because it was based on that mandatory release and not on the guidelines. The last paragraph of Lafayette.
I don't think first of all, supervised release, that's no different than the cases where the mandatory minimum actually applies, and there's no argument the mandatory minimum was incorrect. In all of those cases...
Oh, you're saying where there was no challenge to the mandatory minimum?
Right. In all of the cases where a person is serving a mandatory minimum, those people filed pro se cases down below and below. In each case, the same process was gone through. The probation office recalculated the guidelines and showed that the guideline sentence was reduced.
Yeah.
But then the court had no authority
That's not what happened in Polk, though. And that's the case. That's really the only case we cite, right? Polk is a case where the challenge, there was an Apprendi, where there was a mandatory minimum, there's an Apprendi challenge on the basis that there had been no finding by the jury with respect to quantity.
I thought, and I can double check it when I said it, I thought Polk had actually pled guilty to over 50
grams. That's right. But that is correct. But he made an Apprendi challenge.
He made an Apprendi challenge. He did. But his Apprendi challenge is no different than Mr. Lafayette's Apprendi challenge. And our dispute with Polk is that it skips over the analysis of whether or not of the first. It skips right to the end of whether or not there's a mandatory minimum that applies. The court can't do that. When you look at 3580...
No, you may not like Polk, but we approved Polk in Apprendi, in Lafayette.
You approved the end result of Polk, which is if there's a mandatory minimum that applies, and this is true of every case, if there's a mandatory minimum that applies, the court can't reduce it because the statute requires that sentence. So you approved that, but you didn't address the issue of whether or not someone... what makes you eligible for 3582 resentencing? And once you recalculate those guideline range, you then turn to 5G1.1 and compare.
Did Lafayette not have an Apprendi challenge to the mandatory minimum? He didn't make any kind of Apprendi argument?
Lafayette was challenging whether or not the court had to, whether or not when the court denied the sentence,
But his contention was that the mandatory minimum aspect was unconstitutional, right?
That the sentence was above the mandatory maximum.
No, I'm talking with respect to the supervised release issue. Right? He wound up with a mandatory 5-year supervised release because he came under 841B1A. And right. I thought, did he not say that he only came under 841B1A unconstitutionally, that is in violation of Apprendi?
His supervised release term?
Yeah.
But that gets to the same result as the court said with regard to the initial Apprendi problem, is if the court's not reopening the sentence, then the court isn't determining what a new sentence is. And Section 3582 refers only to terms of imprisonment.
It does, but our court said even assuming that it covered supervised release. So it went on to an analysis as if supervised release were regarded as a term of imprisonment, which, as I understand, federal public defender is disputing in another case whether it's covered as well. So it was perfectly appropriate for the court to do it that way.
Not exactly. That isn't the case.
We're getting far afield here.
Could
we hear from the appellee, and then we'll give you some time?
Ask counsel one hypothetical. Suppose you have a case where the district judge makes a calculation of the guideline sentence, which is completely wrong, and then gives a mandatory, and there's a proper objection, and then sentences pursuant to a mandatory minimum. And then on appeal, the counsel argues this totally botched calculation of the guideline sentence. But there is no claim against the application of the mandatory minimum. Would this court not find that to be harmless error?
Yes, but that would be a different circumstance.
We would find it to be harmless error.
Because the only sentence that could be...
We would, yes. Right? Surely. And so you're saying that a term of imprisonment is based on a sentencing range, even in circumstances where the calculation of the sentencing range is completely irrelevant to the outcome, completely irrelevant.
I don't think it's ever completely irrelevant because it didn't... Because you couldn't get to that outcome without determining the sentencing range, and more importantly,
you couldn't, in the sense that but there's no causal connection. The guidelines require the judge to go through a certain intellectual exercise, but only a part of that exercise counts.
That's true. But if the 3582 wanted to limit its application only when that calculation of that range counts, it could have said that, but it doesn't say that.
All right, why don't we hear from counsel for appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Mike Lambrosino for appellee. 3582C2 provides a very narrow exception to the rule on finality in sentencing.
What do you think we meant in that sentence I referred to in Lafayette? Where we said, quote, here the district court already had discretion within the revised guideline range to do anything, from leaving Lafayette's sentence untouched as it did to ordering him released immediately. That's a direct quote. Is Lafayette referring to step one?
I think that there was some discretion on some of the claims in Lafayette, unlike here, because there was not the operation of the mandatory minimum. So I think that although Lafayette raised some similar claims that are being raised here, and in particular, he claimed that the court erred when it acted without a jury in finding drug quantity. But in that case, you did not have the same operation of the mandatory minimum.
All right, now let me ask you, do you agree that the defendant was convicted of 841B1C?
In this case?
Yes.
Under the procedures, under the
laws,
it was understood at the time.
Yes or no?
Yes.
All right. So now we know, after Webb and after Fields, clearly that there is no mandatory minimum for a sentence under C.
Correct.
And if we had read the statute back in 1994, wouldn't we have seen that as well?
Had Webb been decided?
No, ignore Webb. We're looking at just the statutory language in 841.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
We would have seen, had we been the district court judge in 94, that there was no mandatory minimum to be applied. So the only question I have here is, when Lafayette says, since this is our most recent interpretation, and I'm referring, incidentally, so we're all on the same page here, to the opinion that was decided by this court on
November 3rd,
2009. All right. When Lafayette says, in talking about the amendment, that this is a narrow opportunity under 3582, so that you can't look at anything that's wholly unrelated. Is it the government's position that if the district court looks at a motion under 3582C2 and goes through step one, and then perchance happens to read 841 A1C and says, oh, there's no mandatory minimum here. The statute doesn't authorize it. Is the district powerless to act because all he has before him is a 3582 motion?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's consistent with the language in Lafayette, where the court states to the extent Lafayette's sentence may have constitutional infirmities, they are features of earlier sentencing decisions, not the district court's latest narrow Section 3582C2
determination. So if you can't raise a constitutional claim, you clearly can't raise a claim that the statute doesn't authorize the sentence that was imposed.
Precisely. Whether you characterize that infirmity as one based on a constitutional claim or a statutory claim under Webb, as Your Honor noted, you still can't get there by operation of 3582 because you can't satisfy the plain language of the statute.
So I gather under Lafayette as well, that while the government might argue that the government might argue that the defendant could pursue that argument through a motion under 2255, here this defendant, having previously filed a 2255 motion,
correct,
would be subject to the higher standard under subsection H and therefore would not be able to obtain any relief.
Would not be able to satisfy the gatekeeping function, I would agree with Your Honor.
So there's no relief here, even though we all know that Congress never authorized a mandatory minimum for the conviction of which this man was, of the offense for which this man was convicted. Is that where we are?
I would say that's correct, Your Honor, and that's consistent with the plain language of the statute, because the only way in which a prisoner can gain relief under 3582 under the plain language is if the sentence was based on a sentencing range that was subsequently reduced, and that simply has not occurred here. There was no sentencing range here under 5G 1.1, because
what happened was totally unauthorized by Congress.
I would agree with Your Honor, and that would go back to in Lafayette, where there was what the court characterized as a potential constitutional infirmity under Apprendi and Booker, that the court just couldn't reach that. And I note that it is the exact same claim that was made by Lafayette. I mean, this is also a quote that Lafayette claimed that the district court originally erred when it imposed a sentence, quote, that it acted without a jury finding of drug quantity. Now, that claim is precisely the claim that's being made here. It was characterized as a constitutional claim there, but it's the exact same claim, and you cannot get there through 3582 because there was no sentencing range in this case, and that's consistent with the clear and unambiguous language of 5G 1.1, which states that the mandatory minimum becomes the guideline sentence. There is no sentencing range. And it's also consistent with the Tenth Circuit's decision in Polk, which this court recently cited with approval, which states that Polk was not entitled to a reduction because he was not sentenced based on a sentencing range, but rather based upon the statutory mandatory minimum. And that's exactly what occurred here.
Can I ask? You answered Judge Rogers that he was convicted under 841C, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
But if you look at the judgment and conviction in this case, page 15 of the appendix, he was convicted, according to the court, under 841B1A3. So the real, and which was erroneous, but nonetheless, that's what he was convicted under, not under C.
That is what the judgment was entered under. That's correct, because the district court, in accordance with procedure in place at the time prior to Webb, did make a finding by preponderance that he
right.
had possessed
so his conviction
the
was under the mandatory minimum, erroneous, but under the mandatory minimum.
Oh, exactly, yes.
And that's what we said in Lafayette. At least with respect to any kind of constitutional claim, the Supreme Court has said that it's not retroactive.
Exactly, and I misspoke if I
I think
answered.
You were consistent.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Can you explain what you think? What was the Apprendi issue that was discussed in Lafayette? So, as I understand your exchange with Judge Rogers, and I think it's correct, is that The court basically said the first step wasn't satisfied here. 3582 doesn't apply, and therefore you don't get to the next question. What is the court saying in Lafayette about Apprendi and Booker?
Of course, there's no. It's a distinguished factually from this case in a way that I don't think it's material.
Before you distinguish it, say what it is.
Yes.
What did we hold in that case?
The court held here that although there was a constitutional infirmity, that it was it did not fall. It was not a constitutional infirmity that could be remedied under 3582C2. I'm looking at
that. Is that a discussion at the first step, at the second step, some other step? Why does that discussion of Apprendi come in at all in Lafayette? The first question, I take it, is does 3582 apply? And then if it does the court abuse its discretion in the way in which it applies it? Does it come in at the first step of whether it applies at all?
I believe when dealing with that particular claim in Lafayette, it comes in with the Lafayette had a number of claims, but in addressing Lafayette's Apprendi claim, I believe that it comes in at the initial part of the analysis because, and I think the conclusion mandates that, Your Honor, because if you can't reach a constitutional infirmity, what you're saying is you don't meet the requisite criteria of the statute.
What was his Apprendi claim?
His Apprendi claim was that in his particular case, unlike here, he actually fell within, he had a potential Apprendi claim because mandatory minimum exceeded the statutory maximum, unlike here. So the appellant here has no Apprendi claim because the mandatory minimum fell below the statutory maximum.
But it was still a claim that the sentence was unlawful, that the mandatory minimum was unlawful, right?
Exactly.
And here the claim is also that the mandatory minimum was unlawful. Is that right?
Exactly.
And the first on a strictly constitutional ground, the second on Webb, which was based on Fields, which felt it was required to interpret the statute in order to avoid a constitutional problem.
Point me where in Lafayette what you said is just clear. Lafayette says, relying on this provision, appellant moved for a sentence reduction based on the recent guidelines amendment and also sought to use his motion as a vehicle to gain retroactive benefit of Apprendi and Booker. And that's what
the court sounds like a step two question.
That's what the court was dealing with.
I was looking at two different parts of the opinion, page 4 and page 6, and I was looking at the language that to the extent Lafayette's sentence may have constitutional infirmities, they are features of earlier sentencing decisions, not the district court's latest narrow 3582C2 determination. And I read that to say if there's a constitutional infirmity, you can't get there through 3582, and I think that's the proper reading.
It seems to me the key thing is the first sentence on page star 2, which says Lafayette recently became eligible for this exception, referring to 3852, a matter totally undisputed in that case and hotly disputed here. So I guess I'm at a loss to see how Lafayette actually sheds light on our problem.
Well, it does so in two ways. First, the language on, I'm not looking at the slip up. I'm looking at it by page number. I'm citing it by page number. The language that I just cited to, where I read that to say you can't get to a constitutional infirmity through the language, but I think you also get there, Your Honor, by the language at the end of the opinion, where the court cites to the Tenth Circuit decision in Polk with approval, where that analysis in Polk by the Tenth Circuit I apologize, Your Honor.
It's the Ninth Circuit case.
The Ninth Circuit, yes, Your Honor. That analysis states quite clearly that you don't get out of the gate on a 3582 claim if you were sentenced pursuant to a mandatory minimum. And I think when you read the language in the middle of the Lafayette opinion where it talks about how you can't remedy a constitutional infirmity combined with its citing of Paulk with approval, I think it's fair to read the opinion as saying that you don't get out of the gate.
That may well be, but I think that if you don't get through what Judge Garland has designated step one, the point is moot for our case.
Well, that might be true, Your Honor, but...
You don't have to object to it.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that that last paragraph is a step one question. I'm trying to figure out, that is, I'm trying to figure out whether the other part of the of Lafayette it relates to step one, or if not, is it the same as the question, same as the question the Supreme Court granted cert on, which is what happens after you get to step one? Does Booker apply? And I'm not sure. That's why I want to ask both you and opposing counsel that.
Well, I think because Lafayette, unlike appellant here, had a number of claims, but I think what's clear in addressing his Apprendi claim is that the opinion made clear that you can't go back and fix infirmities in the original sentencing. And I think that's because you don't get out of the gate. You can't satisfy the initial step under 3582 because there was no reduction in the sentencing range where you have the application of a mandatory minimum. Now, I know that's distinguishable. Our opinion is a little, our fact scenario is a little different from Lafayette.
The difference in Lafayette, I take it, he had a 292-month sentence, which is greater than the mandatory minimum.
Exactly.
So we don't have a strict mandatory minimum kind of issue. But he said that the amount above 240, I guess, right?
Yes.
The amount above 240 violated Apprendi.
Correct.
Right? So he had a constitutional claim about that. But he also had a reduction from the sentencing guidelines about that.
Correct.
So why was his Apprendi, would his Apprendi claim have brought him even lower? I mean, what was it?
Yes.
Unfortunately, the Apprendi claim is not discussed. The exact nature of it is not discussed in the opinion, and that's what I'm...
That's the implication in the opinion, but I'm not... But I don't think it bears out the implications. But that,
and so what do you do with our sentence in Lafayette? Just what's the government's reading of this sentence? The district court already had discretion within the revised guidelines to do anything. And leaving Lafayette's sentence untouched as it did... or order him released immediately. I mean, that sounds to me like the court is saying, and we're using step one and step two in two different ways here. One is the way Judge Garland is using it, and the other is the way counsel for appellant is using it. So looking at step one as sort of the Gall type step one, G-A-L-L, is that sentence in Lafayette addressing step one in the Gall sense?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I don't think it is. I think that you can't get around the fact that that to the extent there is a constitutional or statutory violation that does not pertain to a reduction in a guideline range, you just can't reach that.
True, but I guess when I read that sentence, I thought, well, you know, it's almost like it's treating it as a resentencing. I can do anything within the guideline range.
I would agree, Your Honor, if you read that sentence in isolation, but when you read it in the context of the entire opinion, the entire opinion in Lafayette makes clear that it's not a complete resentencing. It's very narrow in scope, and it must be read in accordance with the other guideline provisions, with the policy, and with the application notes. And when you read those in their entirety, each and every aspect, not just of the statute, but of the guideline provision and the application note that we rely upon, it's
quite...
But just to take
a hypothetical here. If in Lafayette the court had decided, well, under this new guideline range, since you get the benefit of the amendment, you know, ignoring all your other arguments, you know, I'm going to exercise my discretion. You don't think the district court has authority to do that?
No, I don't think that under the plain language of the statute, were under any of the guideline provisions that a court could ignore the operation of another statutory provision, that being the mandatory minimum. And I think the application notes are quite clear on that. In fact, the example given in the application notes of the operation of another guideline or statutory provision is the operation of a mandatory minimum. I mean, that's operation note 1A, application note 1A states that specifically. And so I think the only way that can be read is that the Sentencing Commission was quite clear that it was not attempting, nor could it, alter the application of a mandatory minimum sentence.
I don't understand your opposing counsel to disagree with you with respect to a lawful mandatory minimum. Her argument is only with respect to an unlawful one, right?
Correct, but what counsel, I think what the counsel stated early on in her argument that there's only one applicable guideline range, and I would agree with that. And under 5G1.1, the only applicable guideline range here was the mandatory minimum by operation of that guideline. And so they can't, they're really trying to circumvent the plain language of the statute.
Which statute?
Oh, 3582, yeah. Your Honor. And then the first part of that statute where it talks about requiring that it must be based on a sentencing range that was lowered. And as the Third Circuit noted in Mateo, the sentencing range is the end result. It's not the steps that are taken. It's not the tentative results and all the interim steps. It's the end result of the guideline calculus that you have to look at. And
all right.
The court has nothing further than I'd ask that the
Thank
judgment
you,
of the district court be affirmed.
Counsel for appellant.
Could you help us, on, especially since you represented Lafayette, could you give us an idea of sort of why is there a discussion of Apprendi in Lafayette?
Because Mr. Lafayette was saying that when the court denied his 3582 motion, the court essentially reimposed a sentence, and that opened up Booker and Apprendi. And that's the only way this court looked at it. And the court left open the question of whether or not, if you're going to resentence, it has to be a legal sentence consistent with Apprendi and Booker. It didn't address that issue.
That was a Ninth Circuit opinion. That, right?
Correct. And it specifically left that open.
And that's the issue that the Supreme Court took cert on.
I'm not aware of that, but
yesterday. So, it's all right.
But here we are. So Lafayette didn't address step one because everyone agreed step one was there, that the court had the discretion to reduce
because
the sentence.
Because it was above the mandatory minimum.
Because it was above the statutory maximum.
Well, but it was the mandatory minimum was 24. Oh, it was 240. Because he was a repeater.
Correct. Under, mistakenly, 240.
No, I understand. I understand.
But what the court originally thought, right. So his guidelines were above it. So Lafayette really didn't even address the issue that we have here.
Right.
And the crux of the problem with the interpretation of the statute that the government has is just what government counsel just said, is that his guideline range became the mandatory minimum. But the guidelines are very clear. The guideline range never, the mandatory minimum never becomes the guideline range. At most, what 5G1.1 says is the guideline, is the mandatory minimum becomes the guideline sentence, which is a very different word, and the court has to give meaning to each separate use of different words. And the statute 3582 did not say if your guideline sentence was reduced, you can have a reduction. It says if your guideline range was reduced, you can have a reduction. And very clearly here, the only guideline range, and even the district court said the guideline range that applies is the one that's been reduced. That's the range. That's what the statute refers to. The government would have the court skip the steps that includes that range and get right to the mandatory minimum and not look at whether or not the range was reduced.
In the example, I just want to be sure also of the argument of what I said was your position when I was speaking to opposing counsel. Your position is that if the mandatory minimum were lawful, that is, if a jury had found more than 50 grams, and say, for example, a jury had found he was a repeater, although that's apparently not required, then you wouldn't have an argument, that, or you would?
The only reason I wouldn't have an argument then is because once you do the calculation, you determine the sentencing range, then the court can't reduce the sentence because the statutory mandatory minimum is still there. The guideline range has been reduced, and ordinarily 3582.
So you would still say it was based on a sentencing range that has subsequently been lowered.
Right, and you get past that. Now, all these other courts that have looked at the mandatory minimum cases have skipped that. But in practice, before the district court, those steps haven't been skipped. People who filed motions and have been serving mandatory minimums, the probation office still redoes the calculation. Right. The court looks at it.
All right, then why? So I'm going to drive you back to that last paragraph in Lafayette.
And I looked at that again, yeah. And I think that the Mr. Lafayette wasn't making an Apprendi claim with regard to the supervised release because his five-year term of supervised release was within what was allowable. And now the court does then refer to the mandatory minimum nature of the supervised release. But again, the district court didn't exercise its authority to resentence. So at best, this can be read as saying that the district court here chose not to exercise its authority to reimpose sentence, so he couldn't be required to reduce it.
But let's, just looking at that for a minute, it says Lafayette's five-year term of supervised release is mandated by 841B1A. That sentence provides that any sentence under this subparagraph shall, in the absence of a prior conviction, impose a term of supervised release of at least 5 years. Because his count four sentence was a sentence under this subparagraph, the district court had no authority, not that this court decided against, had no authority to grant the request of reduction. And then citing Pauk for the proposition that a district court may not reduce sentences based on mandatory statutory minimum under section 3582C2.
And Pauk collects all of those cases in which the mandatory minimum was lawful. And so I'm not saying anything different than that.
No, but that sounds like the court is saying at step one, as we've been using that phrase, that it doesn't come into play where there's a mandatory minimum. Your argument is that it does come into play even with a mandatory minimum, but that, in the end, it doesn't help the defendant.
Right, and Lafayette didn't make the argument that I'm making here. And so the court's reference to Polk isn't controlling here because those cases are cases in which there was a mandatory minimum that wasn't challenged. And it just essentially what they're doing is skipping over the steps. And I can see why the court would do that because it makes sense to shortcut the process because you're going to get to the mandatory minimum anyway. But here, where the mandatory minimum, everyone agrees, was wrongly applied, you need to look at what the statute requires. And the statute does require that you start at the guideline range. And there is only one guideline range. And so once you have that authority, then the question is whether or not the court has to reimpose what everyone agrees is an illegal sentence.
All right, we'll take the case under advisement. Thank you, counsel.